you for the introduction. Good afternoon to you all. I've just been told that the presenter coming to present after me has decided not to, so I have, 30 minutes to go on? So anyway, I'll try to go slow. I have like 22 slides, but I'll try to provide as much information as I can and fill that space. So I work for an organization called ICARDA, which stands for International Center for Agricultural Research in Dry Areas. So we specialize in agriculture where water is scarce, rainfall is scarce, and typically never exceeding 350 millimeters a year, and most of it coming during winter time, so Mediterranean kind of climate. But there are these two studies I'm presenting that we conducted, and we are starting to conclude these. Like, these are results which are preliminary, and we will have better results when we publish probably middle of next year. So the first one is in Uzbekistan, and it's based on evapotranspiration-based irrigation scheduling to improve water use efficiency and build some resilience. And the second one is in Kazakhstan. That's a neighboring country to Uzbekistan. And it's on valuation of ecosystem services for improving agricultural water productivity. Here is a map showing the two countries and the exact locations. So here's Uzbekistan, and to the northeast is Kazakhstan. And one of the sites is called the Fargana. It's the Fargana Valley. It's like the breadbasket of Uzbekistan, very fertile lands, and not having much problem of salinity or water logging or whatever you have associated with irrigation typically. And the other one related with Uzbekistan, the other site is called the Khorizm, which is in the Aral Sea Basin. It's to the northwest, and the water drains into the Aral Sea. And the other study that's in Kazakhstan is in this Bugunsky Reservoir, and there's a dam here, Chardara Dam, that's where the water releases from and also drains into the Aral Sea. So the thing that's common between the two is the Aral Sea. Now, going into the first study, we did it with an expert from the USDA, and the methodology as such is not very innovative. What's innovative about this presentation is how we have adapted it to the realities of a developing country, the constraints that the farmer faced there, and trying to customize this to the local realities and trying to make it work there. So how to make it more practical for the people there who have limited resources, a lot of government interference, and still trying to make a living out of agriculture. So the entire former Soviet Union was divided into 9 hydromodule zones. Back in the 60s, they divided it based on the depth of groundwater and the soil type. So if you're trying to grow a crop, say cotton, then based on your soil, based on the depth of the groundwater, there were certain recommendations on how much irrigation to apply and how many times a year. So when the Soviet Union collapsed and all these countries were created, they decided to stick to this system of hydromodule zones, which divides the irrigated area into these zones, 1 through 9. And each, like I said, hydromodule zone is a crop-specific recommendation based on soil characteristics such as thickness of soil layer, texture, and the depth of groundwater. The good thing is it's scientific, it's good, but what's bad about it is that these recommendations have not been revised. The cultivars have changed, the groundwater elevation has changed, but the people have never revisited these recommendations. And that's what our project was, that instead of going with these recommendations which need to be revised, let's try to modernize it at the same time, give this power of decision-making to the people who control water. So like in Central Asia, the irrigated area is mostly divided into water user associations. Each association has about 30 to 40 farmers subscribing. They have an agronomist, irrigation engineer, and they are responsible for deciding who gets water and which sequence. And they have their own perception that certain stage requires certain depth of water and it has to be given in a certain sequence. They decide who plants when, and these people are getting older. And average age is about 60 years, 60, 65, 70 years old people also, and they don't have the next generation of agronomists and hydrologists to carry on this work. So we were trying to assist them, give them something that is in local language that they can understand and they can manage, and the next generation can take over. So this is the simple equation of calculating the crop evapotranspiration. You need the crop KC value and the reference ET values. This is the centerpiece of our study. So if you can get the crop coefficient, say from literature or from crop modeling historic data, and if you can get the reference ET from the local weather, then you can solve this equation. And that's what we decided to do. This is our experimental design. So we chose three predominant hydromodule zones, the number 1, 2, and 8, and those collectively cover about 35 to 50% of the study area. So we, for each hydromodule zone, we decided to go to the farmer's field, and we divide the area into two with a buffer in between. So there's this traditional irrigation, which the farmer is doing the way he is recommended to do by the Water User Association, and the ET-based irrigation scheduling where we are telling him how much and when to apply. And the way it works is we have a weather station for the Water User Association. We know the hydromodule zones for these three, the 1, 2, and 8. And based on the ET, based on the KC value, we know for daily time step how much is the ET loss. So we have a spreadsheet here having rainfall and irrigation as positive values and loss as ET as a negative value. And we solve this equation, and whenever we see a stress, it tells the agronomist or the irrigation engineer to recommend application of irrigation. So if we do it the correct way, there should not be excess water, there should not be depercolation, there should not be elevation of groundwater. It should stabilize to the level where it is. So if there is a water logging problem or a logging problem that is anticipated to happen, it won't happen if we adopt this methodology. So these are quickly the results. So the Khorasan area, which is to the northwest, is also hydromodule zone 8. And then we have the Fergana Valley, the three hydromodule zones. And what we see here is the water applied conventional versus the ET, and you can see a reduction, much less water being applied. And you see the yields, they're almost the same. So we are not losing productivity, and so our water productivity improves a lot, because for the lesser amount of water, we are ending up with the same amount of yields. And people have done the yield gap analysis, and they have found that the yields are very close to the achievable or the potential level. So there is not much scope of improving the yields by management practices. It's just the water application that you can reduce, because everything else, they're doing it the right way. The seed variety, the land preparation, everything is optimal. So these are the results from the first study. Here's a graph showing the KC value. We got a good match between observed and predicted value. The shape is perfect. And what we found was there was a 32% saving of irrigation water and a 50% increase in water productivity. And this pilot area, like I said, was representative of the 35% of the total area in Fergana Valley and Aral Sea Basin. So we are hoping that this thing will be taken up by the local water user associations. All they need to invest is in a weather station, and we have customized all this research into the local language. So we have a Russian version of the ET calculator. We have all the policy briefs, everything, and we have joined hands with the local provincial government. It's called the Hakimiyat, and we have endorsements from them saying this is a good thing. We would like to get involved, and we would like to invest in this kind of a technology so that more water user associations also adopt this. And once you have the perfect PC values, you don't need to have TDRs, you don't need to have soil moisture sensors, you just have to have a weather station to carry this thing forward. Next one that I want to go to is the valuation of ecosystem services. This study we did in the Aral Sea Basin of Kazakhstan, and we had University of Minnesota and Texas A&M experts participate. Dr. David Muller is here. He was one of the expert consultants on this project. And so one more time, revisiting the map, because it's more important to understand. Here is a place, there's a reservoir. It's a dam called the Chardara Reservoir. It was built in the 1960s, mainly for the purpose of irrigation and hydroelectric power generation. And the water leaves from here and starts flowing to the northwest and ending in the Aral Sea. And we all know about the disaster that happened in the Aral Sea and how it all disappeared. So one of the objectives of this study was to see, when the water leaves from the Chardara Dam, how is it utilized by different users, agricultural as well as non-agricultural. And this is mainly all the irrigated agriculture that exists in Kazakhstan. The rest of it is mostly rangelands, grasslands. So if we are to look at the role of irrigated agriculture as the main culprit or the main user of water, then this is the best area to study this topic. So we start looking in a sequential manner. When the water leaves the Chardara Dam, who are the users, how much do they withdraw, how much do they return, and what's the quality and the quantity. So in a sequential manner, trying to map all the users of this water, and then trying to understand where is it that the water use efficiency is low and there is opportunity for improving. Also, one more thing that we looked at, and then this area was too big to monitor, to understand. So what we did was we chose a smaller area. This is called the Turkestan Main Canal area. And this is also representative of the bigger area. So we did some intense monitoring here, trying to understand the cropping pattern, trying to understand how the men and women relate with the water. Like, how do they draw their livelihoods from water? Is it a primary school they run? Is it aquaculture? How is it water becomes important in their day-to-day decision making? So we did modeling of this area, but at the same time we did intense monitoring as well as modeling of the smaller area, assuming it represents a bigger one and the results can be outscaled. So in this area, agriculture consumes large amounts of water. It's about 80% of all the freshwater withdrawals used are for irrigated agriculture. And then they mainly grow cotton, corn, alfalfa, and some fruits and vegetables. And irrigation is very inefficient here. It's mostly flood irrigated. And canals lose about 50% of their water supply. And at field scale, we get only 30% they lose, and then 50% is the on-farm irrigation efficiency. So we can see that the water application is too much. And one of the reasons for that is there is unreliable supply of water. Whatever quantity they get, whenever they get, they apply, because they don't know when the next dose of water will become available to them. So farmers over-irrigate, but at the same time, they have limited control over water. So it's not like they know a certain amount is coming and they have that assurance that they would apply the correct amounts, even if they're recommended to apply the correct amounts. So our hypothesis for this study was that improving agricultural water management will lead to improvements of other downstream ecosystems. So agriculture is not a standalone user of water. It's part of a landscape. And since it's the major user of water, any improvement in agricultural water management and related efficiency, you have more water available for other users. So if there is a Coca-Cola plant downstream, or if there is aquaculture downstream, they need that water. So if agricultural practices require an investment, and farmer is unwilling to invest in those probably these people who wish to have this excess water available to them are willing to talk to the farmer and compensate the farmer. So we can have a dialogue between the two. So we can have, and so through identification and valuation of main water-related ecosystem services, we can develop a plan for payment. So if I tell a farmer, please do land leveling, it will improve your efficiency, he would say, does it increase my productivity? And I would say, not really, it will save some water. And he says, well, water is for free. I don't pay anything for it. Why should I listen to you? Why should I level my land if it's not going to increase my profits? So if we can have a plan in which somebody else who wants that excess water is willing to talk to the farmer and compensate the farmer to adopt these practices, probably he's willing to listen to them. So that's what we were trying to do, was first of all see what are these practices that will improve the water use efficiency, and then how much will it cost? And once we know the cost involved, we can have two sets of people who would be willing to compensate the farmer. Typically in Kazakhstan, the government spends about $1 billion annually in subsidies, which are not very targeted. They just say, if you want to have drip irrigation, we will subsidize you by 70%. Or if you want to have orchards, we will give you a certain amount. So it's not site-specific. Even if it's very marginal quality land, the subsidies are very flatly targeted, and it's not very smart way of doing it. The other set of people who would be interested would be the people who are non-agricultural users of water. So if I go to a lady in the local village and say, you are running an aquaculture business, would you be happier if you had better quality water for growing your fisheries? Do you think you can have other species grow which you could sell for a premium? And if she says yes, then you ask, what's your willingness to pay for that? So it's not like saying, this is what's the actual cost. If you want to buy, this is how much it's going to cost you. We're looking at their willingness to pay. How much are they able to pay, and how much do they associate with the quality and quantity of good water becoming available to them, especially during peak dry seasons when there is scarcity of water. So that's what we were trying to do here. So the way it worked out was we needed a biophysical model to understand the hydrology. Like I said, when the water leaves Chardara Dam, we wanted to map it to see how does it move through the landscape. So we first of all developed a GIS database. We collected all the information such as land use, soil properties, elevation, reservoir inputs, outputs, all these things were collected, and then we fed into the SWOT model, and Texas A&M University professor helped us do these. And so once we had a good understanding of the water usage, the crop water use, the use by other people, how much is the surface runoff, how much goes into a wetland, then we had, the next step was to link it with an investment plan. So here is where the Rios and the Rios model comes into picture. This is by the Natural Capital Project, and this program is managed by Stanford University and University of Minnesota as a partner in it. So we use the Rios model, which stands for Resource Investment Optimization System. And the objective of this component of the study was to identify a suite of ecosystem services that are affected by alternate practices. So if I say I'm going to apply less fertilizer, then how does it affect the quality of water and the associated ecosystem services? And if I say I'm going to switch from a very water-thirsty crop to something else that requires less amount of water, how does it affect my downstream ecosystem services in terms of how much water, additional water becomes available for somebody else to use? So we link the two models. So outputs of SWOT model become the inputs of the Rios model. And the alternate practices that we evaluated were better fertilizer management, so trying to match the demand with what we are applying, the quantity and the timing, as well as the better irrigation water management. So what if you have a better method of irrigation, switching from flood to furrow or sprinklers, as well as better amount of application, so trying to match the demand with the supply. And trying to substitute existing crops with more water-efficient crops. And then finally, retirement or alternative use of marginal croplands. So we have a lot of area which is sandy, which has steep slope, and that is just not suited for agriculture production. The yields are low, sediment losses are high, and they should not be under agriculture. We try to identify these and try to suggest retirement of these areas. And improved or targeted policies and subsidies. So we want to come up with a set of investment plans for a certain amount of investment, and then say, if you have these many dollars, this is the way to go so that you have best return on your investment, best bang for your buck. So we wanted to come up with scenarios for the policymakers, which are looking at macro level, trying to see how to, in future, plan to spend that money that they have. So here is a glimpse of Rio's modeling that was carried out in the project. So here it shows the net cost of conversion. So how much is the cost minus the income gain with and without subsidies from the government. So what if you were to choose, you're growing cotton under flood irrigation and you want to switch to cotton under drip irrigation. This is the cost in US dollars per hectare of conversion. So if you are telling farmer to make this change and he's not gaining as much as he's investing, somebody else has to compensate him this amount. Same is an example for alfalfa from flood to sprinkler. This is the cost involved. So we are trying to understand, it's not just simply an extension agent going and saying, this is what is best for you, but we are also trying to make it practical and trying to see what's the cost involved and who's going to bear that bill. So here is a scenario, scenario A, in which we assume we have an investment of $100 million available for this smaller area, the TMC. And what we are trying to do here is for $100 million, we are saying, let's convert 50% to drip irrigated orchard, 30% of area to drip irrigated cotton, and 20% to sprinkler irrigated alfalfa. So these are the total amounts in hectares, 20,000, 11,000, and 7,000. So this is the total area that can be targeted if you have $100 million to invest. And here are the locations of these investments. So in pink, you have drip irrigated orchards, blue are irrigated cotton, and the green is sprinkler irrigated alfalfa. And if you were to make this switch, this is the total amount of water that frees up, that becomes available either for expansion of agriculture or for refilling the Aral Sea, or it could be used for other economic activities in the municipalities. So it depends who has access to this water and who is willing to pay for this $100 million that needs to be invested for making this change. Here's another scenario B in which we change the fraction. So we still have $100 million budget, but we change to 70%, 20%, and 10%, and then the water saving changes. It increases. But all these numbers mean nothing unless you have a buy-in from the stakeholders. So these are all hypothetical numbers. The next step that needs to be taken is to take these to the people who are required to make these change and people who are required to pay this bill. So we have another scenario C in which you change the fractions and then the water saving starts going down. And what we did was we took these scenarios to a roundtable discussion with the policymakers, the provincial people who actually decide how to distribute the subsidies, the money they have, the billion-dollar budget they have annually. And what they said was most practical ratio for them was 20% drip irrigated orchard, 30% drip irrigated cotton, and 50% sprinkler irrigated alfalfa, leading to 141 million cubic meters of water saving. So it's a much less saving of water, but that's what they think can be sold as an idea, and it sounds very practical to them. So based on the discussion with these policymakers, we came up with this scenario. And just during last week of October, we had another fixed group discussion with a set of male and female users of water and asking them, what is it that you do with water to earn a living? How much are you willing to pay for better quality, quantity water being available certain time of the year? And then trying to understand their willingness to pay. So that part is still ongoing. I don't have results for that, but what we are trying to achieve at the end is trying to look at agriculture as a part of a landscape, and there are other users as well as nature that needs this water, and we should not be focusing agriculture as a separate sector, because that water, that finite amount of water, is to be shared by all, and there has to be an investment plan so that nature also has a say in this and not always loses out. So that's my conclusion from this case study, that agriculture cannot be managed in isolation from the rest of the landscape. It has to be looked at inclusively. With that, I will stop talking. Thank you so much. Well, when you look at the cost of production, the cost of water is really small. And if you tell him to switch to drip irrigation, it's probably the cost of energy that's the main cost involved. It's not the actual amount that he spends for water. It's usually $2-3 for the whole growing season, or even less. Supposed to be a free resource from God that is there for all to share, and you cannot stop it, you cannot deprive anybody of it. Yeah, there is. There's a big intergovernmental body that is looking at how to restore, how to revive environmental flows, so that you can have some kind of restoration of the Aral Sea and the biodiversity that has been lost. And it's not just Kazakhstan; it's also Uzbekistan and other countries. They all drain into Aral Sea, and they are meeting regularly to come up with policies and investment plans on how you can increase the supply of water to the Aral Sea without adversely affecting the productivity of the poor farmers. The way it works in Uzbekistan is really strange. Like, the government provides you seed, government provides you fertilizer, government tells you when to plant, and government tells you what's your yield target. And then they tell you when to harvest, they procure the crop from you at a certain price, and then they sell it in the international market. So farmer doesn't have much control over what he can do to improve the productivity, the management, or his profits. And so that's why the first study that I showed you on the ET, we are trying the water user associations, because they are the ones who actually control the flow of water. Whereas in Kazakhstan, it's a little more free. They have freedom to decide what to plant, where to get the seeds from, and things like that. So it's a little better situation than Uzbekistan. Thank you.